Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America: The First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And we have a very special guest today. It's comic book writer Mark Waid. Reciting Mark's credits would take longer than this podcast, but during his long career, he's written for Marvel, DC, many independent publishing outfits in print and online. Among his noteworthy books are Kingdom Come with Alex Ross, Superman Birthright, Batman Superman World's Finest, and successful runs on characters including DC's Legion of Superheroes, Superman, Batman, The Flash, Green Lantern, The Justice League, as well as Marvel's X-Men, Spider-Man, The Avengers, The Fantastic Four, and the reason we're having him on today, Captain America. And when I was preparing this intro, I learned he even snuck some Archie in there.
This is true.
It's some Archie comics.
Yes, not once, but twice in my career. Yes.
So comic book writer Gail Simone, who is very successful and highly regarded in her own right, recently wrote online that the closest thing comics has to a quality guarantee is that Mark Waid wrote it.
Wow, that's nice to hear.
And I agree with that. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, sir. Thanks for inviting me.
Thrilled to have you. Hal, tell us about this minute of the movie.
All right, minute 51. Captain America, in his vibrant star-spangled suit, delivers a theatrical punch to an actor dressed as Hitler, the crowd roaring as a title card flashes Chicago. Steve waves to adoring audiences in city after city, his shield gleaming under theater lights. In one audience, Senator Brandt nods with approval, his eyes sharp with calculation. At a bustling newsstand, kids swarm, eagerly snatching up stacks of Captain America issue number one comic books, their faces alight with excitement. In a cramped tent in Europe, Bucky Barnes, Steve's friend, flips through the same comic, his expression a mix of disbelief and amusement. On a Hollywood soundstage, Steve, surrounded by extras dressed as Marines, fires a machine gun in the staged Pacific battle, the camera capturing every heroic pose. The singer's voices surge, vibrant and patriotic. Forceful and ready to defend the red, white, and blue, who'll give the Axis the sack and as smart as a fox, far as an eagle will soar, who's making Adolf afraid to step out of his box. In a theater, Steve watches a film of his own exploits, flashing a game smile as young women around him clap with fervor. A series of wipes showcases the extravagant dance routine of the Captain America stage show, chorus girls high-kicking in perfect sync. After one performance, a boy thrusts out an autograph book, and a beautiful blonde woman beside him smiles warmly. "Hi," she says, holding out her book. Steve, flustered for a moment, grins and signs, his confidence growing. The singers continue. "He knows what we're fighting for. Who waked the giant that napped in America? We know it's no one but Captain America. Who'll finish what they began? Who'll kick the krauts to Japan?" At Radio City Music Hall in New York City, the camera pulls back from the stage, revealing Steve balancing three chorus girls atop a motorcycle. A chorus line high kicks in front of tanks, their cannons firing bursts of confetti. Silhouettes of aircraft soar across the backdrop, and the audience erupts in wild applause. The Star-Spangled Man with a Plan. The scene cuts abruptly to a muddy field in Italy, November 1943, 5 miles from the front. Steve, still in his Captain America costume, stands on a makeshift stage, his voice earnest. "How many of you are ready to help me suck old Adolf on the jaw?" The battle-weary troops, his only audience, stare back in silence, their faces etched with exhaustion, unmoved by his words.
Al, Jim and I really wanted you to sing that part. Yeah.
See, I know. And I dared Jim, Mark, before you came on, I dared Jim to auto-tune me to the song. So
the audience may know. If
the audience may know. And the sad thing is they will immediately turn off and delete the episode, and they'll never hear what you have to say. So, I'm sorry to ruin your first appearance on our show, but boy, I'm sure excited to talk with you, as I know these guys are as well.
Mark, I wanted to just open our conversation talking about the character of Captain America and your work on him. When you sit down to write Captain America, do you have any particular approach or insight into who Steve Rogers is or why he does what he does?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the movie hit it perfectly. I remember distinctly in the film when they ask him, why he wants to fight. And he's like, I just don't like bullies. I was touched in that moment. I actually got a little teary because it was the first time a superhero movie since Christopher Reeve came along, the first time a superhero on the screen didn't have orphan revenge as a motive. And because I hate that as a motive. It works for Batman. It works for certain characters. I'm avenging the death of X or Y or Z, but we keep making it whenever they go to live action, wherever they try to take comic book characters and comic book heroes and turn them into movies, TV shows, that's the easiest path of least resistance. And they always go there. And it just makes me nuts because sometimes you just don't like bullies.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, I mean, I know writers love characters with flaws, like someone who's too cocky or too cynical or morally gray. So I'd be really interested to hear what you think about the challenge of writing a character like Steve Rogers, who is as physically perfect as a human can be, and is the Marvel Universe's beacon of morality. What do you do with a perfect character?
I'm okay with that. Like, I have no trouble writing a character like that. The flawed characters may be a little more fun to write, but you can't ascribe that to Steve. From my point of view, Steve's only failing is that sometimes he is a little too trusting, because that is where his default is. And that just comes from being a New Deal Democrat, right? This comes from being his upbringing and being raised in a slightly more optimistic world, a slightly less dangerous world. And, that's it. I mean, other than that, what I have to sit down and remember every single time, I do remember, but it's something I have to bear in mind, is that here is someone who always has a plan, who always has a way forward, who is never stumped. And that is really hard to write as a writer, as you have to write somebody who's smarter than you are and five steps ahead of you. But he never gives up. He's not interested in that. I do think that at one point, I remember we keep talking. This is like when I was doing, I think, my second of four different runs on Captain America. We were talking about how he represented the American dream. And that all sounded great in the 50s. But when you go online in the early 2000s and Google American dream, it's all about real estate. It's all about owning your own home. And that ain't it. And so I did some thinking about it. I did some real thinking about it on the last tour of duty I did with the Chris Somney stuff about 10 years ago. And I think that Cap's bellwether is not the declaration, it is the Bill of Rights. I think that is his moral and ethical foundation. And that is...
Say more about that.
Well, it's just it is a flawed country, but the idea of being able to fight for the rights of the impoverished, the disenfranchised, I think that is what attracts Steve to the role more than anything else. It's not about fighting for... It's not specifically about fighting for a country rather than people. It is about fighting for people who represent this great country, if that makes any sense. Whether he was wearing the American flag or not, he'd still fight.
That's a profound insight, the idea of the Bill of Rights versus the Declaration of Independence. And when we flash forward, in the MCU, and we're talking Civil War and those plot lines, we do see Steve Rogers he's not on the side of the government of the United States of America. He's not on the side of the country as an institution. He's on the side of what it's supposed to be and the people and what it is.
Yeah, the spirit of what America could be is what he is behind. He is not behind the government. And he's not America love or leave it. He is America love it and help it grow and help it become its best self.
Mark, you've written for both DC and Marvel. Could you, is there any space between what Captain America fights for and what our, classic Silver Age Superman fights for in Truth, Justice, and the American Way? How do you see them as a difference?
A little bit. I mean, with Superman, you have a little more scope and variety in the kind of stories you can tell. You can do science fiction in a way you really can't do with Cap. You can do, you know, basic crime stories. That the single dumbest editorial note I ever got was when I was writing Captain America. And one of the head honchos pulled me aside because I was not writing the book politically. I was not trying to take a specific left-wing or right-wing point of view, but nonetheless, it is Captain America. And I said, the book has to be about America to some degree or another. And the response I got was, Captain America doesn't have to be about America. Spider-Man's not about spiders.
Wow.
Dumbest thing in 40 years that anyone in comics has ever said to me. And I wanted to quit on the spot because, of course, it has to be about America. That's central to everything. And so you can write a Superman story that is not about patriotism. You can write a Superman story that is not about the soul of this country, but you can't write a Captain America story that is not about some aspect of that. Otherwise, it's just, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but nothing interests me less than watching Captain America fight Cobra and Mr. Hyde or whoever, the Gray Gargoyle. I mean, that's anybody can do that. That anytime you write a Captain America story where you could just substitute Spider-Man in instead, it's not a Captain America story.
He has to like fight moral perals, I think is what it is. There's a question of his an opposing morality. Is the stories that I see. I am not as well versed in Captain America's history as Brian is, but from what I've seen, it's where he questions what he's doing and who he's working for, and is this am I doing the right thing?
Am I doing the right thing?
Yeah, and that, you know, is constantly in. I mean, more than anything else, you're saying the Bill of Rights, but to me, it's more like the Scout Oath. It's that, yeah, you know, he's going to do his duty, and this is the duty that he has to the people of America, to the as you were saying, the idea of America, that he has to honor this is on his honor, and his honor matters to him more than anything else, because if he loses his honor, he isn't Captain America anymore.
Right. That's well said. Yes, I think you're absolutely right.
The ultimate Boy Scout, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe probably more than Superman, who often is accused of that.
And I don't know when that became a pejorative, but it did. So yeah. Our lifetime, it became negative to say.
I blame Captain Kirk. That's the.
Yeah. Okay.
He was never a Boy Scout. You know.
Right. Yeah.
So you've said some nice things about the, you know, this movie and the portrayal of Captain America. Okay. I'm curious if you're willing to say what your impression is of Captain America's portrayal in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because we wouldn't be doing this podcast if we didn't love this movie. But I personally think, after reading comics my whole life, that Chris Evans gave Steve more personality than 50 years of comics did. And I'm certainly open to more critical take.
I'm completely with you. I don't think since Christopher Reeve as Superman was there ever any better casting for a superhero in superhero movies, TV. It was just, he's so perfectly bang on, dead solid perfect for that role. And as you say, he is able to bring to it, Chris Evans is able to bring to it a little more personality than the typical way to write Captain America as the complete straight man against everything and everyone else. The stoic, solid, humorless, but well-meaning. You know, he can enjoy a joke. He's not a funny guy. Whereas, you know, Chris gives him a little more swagger and a little more, I guess the best way to put it is, backing way up. When I was working at DC, I was talking to Jeanette Kahn, who was the publisher at the time, and they were talking about casting Superboy for that god awful syndicated Superboy TV show that ran in the early 90s.
Oh yeah.
And she made the point that I've never forgotten. She said, when they're casting for that role, they're looking for someone with a twinkle in their eye. Mm-hmm. And I totally get it. And that's what Chris has. Chris has that charisma that he can convey with just a one look. He has that twinkle in his eye that a lot of actors who are wholesome and toothy and smiling and, you know, positive might not have themselves.
Well, and you never once disbelieve. I have no idea what Chris Evans is like personally, but he never once winks at the audience or makes fun of this character in the same way Chris Reeve didn't. When Chris Reeve says, "I'm here to fight for truth, justice, and the American way," you believe him. He's sincere.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Cap. Utter sincerity portrayed by Chris Evans.
That is, there is never a point in that movie where I felt like I was watching an actor play Captain America. I just felt like I was watching Captain America.
Yeah.
And I think well that said. Actually helped with, I mean, his portrayal, I think, made the other characters in the movie more believable. That, you know, the idea that Bucky was like stunned that this is that kid from Brooklyn that he knew, you know, you actually right. believed he's like, what happened to you? I joined the army, that kind of, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, his work against Hugo Weaving, who is, of course, a great actor in his own right. Mm-hmm. But every moment of that, you got this, no matter how ridiculous the situation that he was in, it felt like, okay, I believe this is what's happening on screen is real life.
Yeah. If the lead character in your superhero movie doesn't take it seriously, then everything else falls apart. Even, even Adam West, as ridiculous as the show was, he played it with 1,000% sincerity.
Yes.
And that's what made it click. He never winked at the camera. He never put his tongue in his cheek. He played it as straight as he possibly could.
Yeah. Well, I had the very common experience of watching it as a kid mm-hmm. and taking Batman 66 deadly seriously.
Oh,
and
yeah.
then realizing when I was a teenager, I realized it was a comedy. But I didn't know that when I was 8 or 9.
No, all I know is that there's these incredible death traps and I better be there Thursday to find out what's going on. By the way, if I ask you, I know we're off topic. Which death trap immediately comes to mind when I say death trap?
Giant clam.
I'm saying what?
Giant clam.
Giant clam.
It's giant clam. I'll tell you exactly why it's giant clam. That is almost everyone's answer. And that is because it was the first time they did a three-part episode instead of a two-part episode. Oh, so my theory is when we were kids, we got to the Thursday night end of the second part, assuming that everything was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And then they threw us this curve with a whole new trap and we had to wait a week to find out what happened next. I think that's why it's burned into our brains, giant clam.
I thought I was watching Robin get eaten by a giant clam.
Yeah,
I thought
totally.
It was over. I thought it was done.
Yeah.
But I like magnifying glass.
I did.
Yeah, also the giant hourglass. That was a good one.
Getting run through by Art Carney on the with their
their lances on the field.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, we've all been there, am I right?
Right.
I
mean, right.
You know. If I had a nickel.
But regardless, I took us off topic. So
it's fine. I mean, to this day, I am afraid to be put in an ambulance because I might fall out the back and
you're gurney headed toward a sign that says, you know, warning cliff in 20,000 feet or whatever. Yeah, right.
Yeah, don't go up Fullerton or Mulholland Drive anywhere near that. You're in trouble.
Switching direction just a little bit, if you don't mind, Jim.
No,
I'm sorry.
No, go right ahead. I have one question, but I'll follow up later.
Where you stand on the controversial topic of death in comics, because as we all know, Bucky falls to his death later in this movie and he stays dead and is never resurrected through all the subsequent Marvel movies. He's dead. I'm being sarcastic.
I know.
Until he's not.
But it's been said that the only permanent death in comics is Spider-Man's Uncle Ben.
Right.
And they used to say that about Bucky too. And mm-hmm. My personal take is Bucky was better off dead. I know people love the Winter Soldier. I wish they'd never brought him back because I think it was something essential to Captain America's character, this guilt he felt over his teenage colleague getting killed. What do you think about death in comics?
As a general rule, I'm against it only because it is such a trope that we all know these characters are going to come back.
Yep.
And so it has zero impact. Anyway, I wrote an issue of Fantastic Four where the original climax, the original cliffhanger was they killed Ben. Ben is dead. And then I realized that's ridiculous. No one is going to believe that. No one over the age of 6 is going to read that comic and go, oh my God, what happens next? So I changed that to Ben is dead. And then an epilogue where the cliffhanger is Reed announces he's going to go to heaven, find some way to go to heaven and bring Ben back. And everybody's looking at him like he's crazy. That's a much better cliffhanger because it doesn't turn on the idea that, oh no, we've killed that character when we didn't. I understand what you're saying about Bucky. Tom Brevoort fought against it until he finally got worn down by Ed Brubaker. And Tom now thinks he made the right decision letting Ed do it. I kind of feel the same way. I felt exactly as you did. Like, what are you doing with Bucky? That's immutable. His death should count for something. But seeing what they've been able to make of that character was all the difference. All the difference. If they'd done anything else with that character that was not as interesting or not as well thought out, then it would have been a complete misfire.
So we're not expecting a zombie Erskine, right? I hope not. I just
I know. I did. Yeah, that's there's no get. There's no getting bringing Erskine back. Yeah.
Yeah.
His death still counts for something.
I have a question. Earlier you were talking about getting these crazy notes from editors. Mm-hmm. How do you push back? Do you treat it as, oh, that's a funny joke, thanks for sending that to me? Or how?
I dealt with it differently 20 years into my career than I do 40 years into my career, right? Again, the more I'm at this, the fewer notes I get, partly because everybody knows after I've written 2,000 comics that I kind of know where the guardrails are. And I don't mind getting notes from editors. Especially on matters of clarity, you know, did I miss something in the script? Did I forget to mention something in the script? Or is there something here that doesn't make any sense except in my own head? But I very rarely get those kind of just straight up dumb notes anymore. And so I don't really have to deal with them. The only time I walked away, I'm trying to think, the only time I really just walked away from a book, not quit, but like walked away, was because I was getting over and over just dumb notes. And it's not my sandbox. They're not my toys. I can push back a little bit because at the end of the day, my name is the name on the comic. And, you know, if people read the comic and they don't like it, they don't look at it and go, well, it must've been badly edited with a bunch of notes. They just go, oh no, Mark Waid sucks. So you try to be diplomatic. You listen to the notes. A lot of times and Brian, I'm sure, can probably back me up on this. A lot of times the notes aren't really the notes. The notes are what the editor is expressing and thinks the problem is.
Yes.
But that's not really the problem. Like I had a guy at DC whose bomb sites were off by 3 pages every single time. Like he had a problem with this scene. And I would look at it and I didn't understand what your problem is with this scene. But if you go back a couple of pages or go forward a couple of pages, I see where there is an issue. So let's, you know, you weren't very good at helping me narrow it down, but at least you flag something. So
The best editing I get is from an editor who will say, something doesn't work here. You figure it out.
That's the worst editing there is. The worst editing.
Oh, love it. Because for me, that's freedom. That's like, I mean, they're more specific. They identify a problem specifically, but let me come up with a solution. I love that kind of editing.
Oh, see, I hate that kind of editing. I do like, let me refer. I don't like fix it this way. That's not what I like. And when I'm an editor, and I've been many, many times, my take is if I don't have a proposed solution, I feel uncomfortable pointing out a problem. Uh-huh. I like it when Tom Brevoort and Paul Kaminski are both the two best editors in comics, my DC editor, my Marvel editor. And Tom Brevoort is famous for never coming to you with a problem unless he has a proposed solution that he is perfectly willing to throw out the window if it doesn't work. But at least there's something there. I hate getting the note that says, something's wrong here. You fix it. I don't know what that means.
We might be saying the same thing because I would generally get some direction, but it's possible we should just never work together.
That's possible too.
Where do you see the notes we're going to have on this podcast? You know, Mark, I don't want to go too far astray, but it's really interesting. You're talking about people being reluctant to come with a problem if they don't have a solution. So I spent many, many years in the software industry on the test engineering side of things. And there's always a philosophical debate. If you're testing software, should you also be a developer? Should you be writing code? Or should you approach it as an end user and use it? And when you find a flaw, you point it out. And what I found in my career was that the more that a tester knew about what was going on under the hood and about writing the code, the shyer they would get about pointing out a problem, because they would scratch their heads and say, well, I kind of know how the code works. I don't know if this is fixable. I don't know how I would fix it. And so it's apples and Buicks or something. It's like very, very far apart. But it was just, it really struck me when you said that, because I was very much in the camp that says the audience for the products that we're making, the consumers of this software product, they don't know or care how it works or what goes on behind the scenes. They just know it doesn't work, and they need that advocate there.
Yes, exactly. That's the role of an editor as well. I mean, I do know I'm better at critiquing writing than I am critiquing art when I'm editing, only because I know principles of art, but I can't draw a comic book. So my attitude was always, as an editor, if it looks wrong to me, it is going to look wrong to people out there.
100%.
And it doesn't 100%. Mean I know how to fix it, but it just means something's off here. Can you please take another look?
You know, something just occurred to me when you said that. It reminded me of an experience I had where I was working on a story. It was my last Mechanical Monster story. And I'd written and drawn 100 pages of it. And every time I went to sat down to draw it, it was a slog. And every time I sat down to write it, I didn't know what to write next. And I realized, if I'm this miserable creating it, everybody else is going to be that miserable reading it.
Absolutely.
And so I changed it completely. I threw that out and I started over from scratch.
That's what you got to do. I mean, that's why it's a slog, is because everybody, this is my theory about writer's block, is that everybody has put together a piece of IKEA furniture in their life. And everybody knows what it's like to get to step 14 and realize you screwed up step 4. Right. Yeah. So writer's block is your subconscious telling you, you have gone the wrong direction. You are going a way that is not the best way to tell the story and not the most exciting to you way to tell the story. And you better go back to the last place it worked and turn left and do something different. So that's totally what it is. You have to love the job. One of the best things I ever heard when I was editing at DC was my boss was Dick Giordano at the time. It was the best editor of all time. Just the best people manager you've ever met. Very creative and very open to letting people run wild, but there to give them guardrails when they needed them. And at that time, I was editing what was an empirically mediocre comic. It was like Olympic level mediocre. And yet I enjoyed reading it for some reason. There was something about it I liked, and I wasn't sure. I went to Dick and I said, what is it about this book? Like, we all know this is a mid-list book, and this is a reason this is a mid-list book. What is it about this that I'm enjoying? And he without blinking, Dick said to me, because the writer would write this one for free and it shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's man, wonderful. Those words have stuck with me my entire career. Like, the moment I'm not having fun, the reader will know and sense it, and they're not going to have any fun either.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's deeply true.
Yeah.
I have a general question. As a non, I'm the only one in this group that is not up in the publishing business, and I always wonder in comics when you pick up a comic book and things like that, and you're reading Spider-Man or Superman or Green Lantern, anything like that, and you're writing through, you have to appreciate the lore. Now, Mark, you and Brian are both deep students of DC, Marvel, any action comics, where all the way back to the Yellow Kid. So that's not a reflection on your age, Brian, so don't worry. It's the thing that I always wonder is, your editor has to be better than you are at understanding lore, I would think, if they're coming in and critiquing.
Oh, you're adorable.
Yeah, I know. I know it's probably not that. But I mean, there must be somewhere in the organization. No. There must be some equivalent. There is. It's just,
it's
you
me,
hope somebody
actually,
should.
This way.
Okay.
It's
okay.
At Marvel, it's Tom Brevoort, who is your, at DC, I'm the guy they call.
Like, yeah, okay.
which is really kind of honorable and or honoring. It makes me feel honored. And it's kind of, because everybody knows I'm the guy that knows. Everything.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're going back and you're drawing something and say, no, no, and not brand X four, Forbishman does this. So it's, yeah, I always wonder how much nerdiness soaks in from the editor's side, but I guess it is the writers that have to know the lore to write the lore.
I mean, it kind of is, because the editors, part of it is that when I was an editor, there was 50 years of DC Comics to know. Now there's 90 years of DC Comics to know. And I can't expect any of my editors who are in their 30s or early 40s to have read so much of that material or know that stuff. So that institutional knowledge just doesn't get passed along. So if and when I get hit by a bus, they're out of luck. That's continuity just goes out the window at that point.
I beg you to correct me on this, Mark, but my take on that question is, for the first several decades of comics, nobody cared about continuity because they figured the readership would be turning over every 6 or 7 years as kids outgrew comics. And what starts to happen in the 60s is, well, college students start reading comics, and then 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds, we've all, I started when I was pen.
It's not so much what the readers were. It was the fact that you got the, and then you get the late 60s to early 70s when Roy comes in and
Roy Thomas
and E. Nelson Bridwell over at DC and so the and Denny O'Neill, Steve Gerber, all these writers who were the first generation of comics writers to be fans
coming in.
Because before then it was all elderly men who it was just a day job to them. They didn't really care.
That's when you started getting the yellow boxes at the bottom of see Green Lantern number 65 at the
That's when it started to become important to both companies, the continuity.
Like, again, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe up into the 60s, comics were where you went if you couldn't make it in newspaper syndication.
Exactly.
Or illustration, you know, advertising illustration.
Yep, or something you do between your advertising jobs if you were lucky enough to grab something at, you know, John Stillman Cushing or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think you pinpointed exactly. It's when fans start to turn pro that continuity becomes important because now you want to tell the story. You want to finish the story you started when you were 8 years old, and now it's 30 years later, you know.
Now there's a downside to that. I mean, I like the upside to that, but the downside to that is that we also – that – started as we got into the 80s and 90s where everything became sort of grim and gritty and dark because now we're dealing with creators who were fans and now in comics who wanted the comics to grow up with them.
Yes, exactly.
And that is how you end up stretching the boundary so far that everything becomes blood and guts and grim and dark and just not really all ages material, which I maintain is what most superheroes should be, is all ages material, because that's what they were created to be. Doesn't mean you can't tell sophisticated stories with them, but at the same time, they're not about cynicism. They're not about darkness. So we seem to recoil back from that to some degree. We seem to clawed our way back in comics to a little more fantasy, you know, the word I'm like wish fulfillment phase. And I'm grateful for that.
I am too. You know, speaking of continuity and all this, it brings up a point. I've been very impressed with how the Marvel Cinematic Universe has created its own continuity.
Yeah.
Sort of taking this dung heap of 80 years of Marvel and creating these very clear through lines. Like, for example, again, correct me if I'm wrong, Howard Stark was in the comics never any part of Captain America's origin story.
No,
and in
no,
the
no,
movies
exactly,
he
yeah.
is, and the, so yeah. you get that line of Howard Stark to Tony Stark, and Tony and you know, Steve Rogers is the kid that Howard Stark wished he had, and you get this whole thing between Tony and Steve that never existed in the comics, but is so rich in the movies. That kind of thing. They built this out of scraps in a cave.
Exactly, starting with a character that nobody knew. I mean, starting with Iron Man, who a character we all know, but you know, our significant others and you know, mothers and grandmothers had no idea who that character was, and they managed to turn that into, you know, into Endgame continues to be what, the third or fourth highest grossing movie of all time. So I being able, like you said, being able to create that continuity that is pretty, I wouldn't say it's airtight, but I would say it's as airtight as Marvel comic continuity is, frankly. It's as airtight as it can get.
Probably as airtight as you can make it across
exactly
30 films or
and
TV series, which sort of the TV shows sort of edge in and out of canon and kind of decide, oh, never mind, this one's not canon anymore. This is getting complicated, but it is a remarkable achievement.
I do have a question about in the cinematic universe, the introduction of the multiverse. Do you think that was a smart idea, or do you think that was like the worst story problem ever thrown into a saga?
It's the law of unintended consequences. I think it was a great idea to plug in, but then once you open that can of worms, man, it becomes crazy, crazy hard to explain to ordinary folks. I mean, I went to a screening of Everywhere, Everything, All at Once, Directors Guild screening, because my girlfriend is in the guild. And I was sitting there with a bunch of normies, you know, a bunch of ordinary people. And afterwards, Patton Oswalt was there as well. And I was able afterward to pull him aside. And the first thing I said to him was, How does it feel to be the only other person in the theater who wasn't confused by the first 45 minutes of this movie?
Yeah.
So it is, it's something. It is, and it, and the tragedy to me is that DC owned the multiverse. That was their concept. DC owned the multiverse forever and ever. And then at some point DC said, we don't want any more multiverse stories for a long time. That's a stupid concept. And Marvel picked up the baton and ran with it. And now they're the ones who are, you know, synonymous with a concept that DC pioneered. But
yeah, they didn't understand the word crisis.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
We're here for your take, Mark, not mine. But I've said before on this podcast that if I live in a universe with 50,000 Spider-Men, why should I care about this one?
Right. That's a big one. And it also, here's something that we don't address either, which is that if you're in that universe and you know there's 50,000 other universes out there, what do your choices mean? Why do they even matter? Why do you do what you do knowing that across the multiverse, there are going to be a bunch of you who are doing a completely different thing, and which one is right and which one is wrong, given the scope of that? I think if you start to sink down that rabbit hole, then, you know, you're just going to end up immobilized. If I were writing some multiverse angle story right now, that's the angle I would take.
Somebody just paralyzed, unable to decide anything.
Because what does it matter? What does it matter if what I do doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, and somebody is doing something exactly the opposite of me to cancel it out anyway?
My prediction is that somewhere there'll be an anti-Thanos who will come in with a cosmic cork to plug up all the other multiverses so that you're left with just one universe.
That'd be great. But
bring some sanity back. Yeah. You know, and it strikes me too that like the idea of this multiverse or an occasional sort of, you know, let's do a carve off a one-off what if type story, that can be very fascinating to me. But then from a storytelling perspective, when you're bringing in all these others, it seems like you've got to spend so much time on some level of exposition saying, no, this isn't your Earth. This is the other one. And you can tell it's different because we've got to show you these six things in a big hurry and establish that it's different. And then, as we said, you know, you guys articulated so very well that once you open that Pandora's box, there's no more consequences. There's no more stakes because none of it matters. Yeah.
No, multiverse is like any other storytelling tool. It is a valid tool, but you don't use the same tool to fix every problem.
Yeah. I had a question. This just occurred to me. I don't know the answer to it. And excuse me if I should. Have you been asked or approached to contribute anything to Marvel movies or television shows or anything? Does the MCU know about you?
They know about me, but they haven't approached. They generally just don't approach the comics people. I think that stigma is still out there. I mean, when you do something like Hawkeye, which is very specific in its vision, then yes, they brought Matt Fraction aboard to help them in some consultancy sort of way. But I don't think Matt wrote any scripts. I think that, you know, when it came to DC, you know, Marvel's very good about acknowledging your contributions, but same at DC. It's not like they're drafting any of us to write any of these TV shows. It's still, you know, that separation of church and state is still there. And I don't quite know why.
You know, it drives me insane. I had a very similar conversation years and years ago with Paul Dini when they were just starting to think about rebooting Superman. Mm-hmm. And I said, are they talking to you? Because as far as I'm concerned, the animated Superman is the best one in decades. Yeah. And Paul just said, no, that they're movies, I'm cartoons, they don't talk to me. And it's insane.
They just got these walls up. And I don't even think they're necessarily even purposeful. I don't even necessarily think they're deliberate. I think that it's just they live in a world of screenwriters. And so that's the pool they look at. It doesn't even occur to them to look outside the pool of screenwriters. Plus, there are way more screenwriters looking for work in what is a very tight field than there are comics writers looking for work. There's more opportunities for comics writers than there are for screenwriters. I would honestly say, and I think that's more true every day as the Hollywood industry just continues to shrink. And so there's also that level of competition. You know, you've got agents upon agents fighting for their clients to take on this gig and that gig. And can they, you know, they want to write the next Batman movie or whatever. We don't even have to stand a chance against people who are career screenwriters.
And it even goes further with Hal and I did the Rocketeer Minute and talked with screenwriters Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, who wrote the Rocketeer screenplay. They had a Hal, you're going to have to help me, the follow-on
Cliff's New York Adventure.
That was the Dave Stevens one. But then he wrote the one that the communist era, the Red Scare.
Yes, that's right.
I can't remember the name of the.
I'm drawing a blank on the title.
They actually wrote a comic book. And it seemed like a natural progression of the Rocketeer taking Cliff Secord or his nearest, you know, the Tamu version of Cliff Secord into the 50s and dealing with McCarthyism and things like that. And the Rocketeer, I think it could be argued is has similar threads in him as Captain America. But it seemed like a natural thing that you could take that that comic book story and turn it into a movie script for a Rocketeer, but nobody even considers it. So it's a frustrating thing that there are so many there's so many stories to be told. Mm-hmm. It's the people that are just making the product itself would listen to the people who know how to make stories that, you know, but that's, I guess that's the way of the world.
You're preaching to the choir. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been a great show. And Mark, thank you. Oh, Brian has
Before we wrap up, Mark, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about anything you're working on, anything fun coming up, anything you want to promote before we say goodbye.
I got to say, well, the most fun thing I've done recently is this Superman Spider-Man book that came out last week. It's just because Brian, I'm sure I speak for you as well. I remember standing on my front porch like Calvin waiting for his propeller beanie to show up in the mail, waiting for my mom to bring home Superman, Spider-Man back
big
in 1966.
Digest size
I have it. It's in my attic right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
So to be able to have that assignment and be able to do the Superman, Spider-Man team up of today was a great deal of fun. So that just came out. And then beyond that, I'm still writing at DC. I'm still writing World's Finest Comics with Superman and Batman. I'm still writing Justice League. I'm still writing Action Comics, which is the adventures of Superman when he was a boy, and a bunch of other scattershot projects at DC here and there, and just having a ball.
Fantastic.
So, Mark, I have to ask real quick, in the Superman Spider-Man book, are there a lot of spiders on the spider side of things? Did you finally get around to proving that, yes, you have to write a lot of spiders with Spider-Man?
Yeah, I said, there's all about it's. He does. Yeah, I will say this. I will say that in a sense, it's a multiverse story only because these characters don't normally work together. But rather than waste time with multiverse portals and, you know, meeting each other for the first time and stuff, I just jump right in with, yeah, Peter and Clark have known each other for a while. Great. And they're friends.
Just like the first one.
Right.
They don't explain
right
it. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. I look forward to reading it. I haven't seen it yet, but
I hope you enjoy it.
I'm
looking forward to it as well.
Fantastic. That sounds like the greatest team up since Roger Rabbit. So
there you go.
Wow. Well, again, Mark, thanks so much for being part of our show, and I'd also like to thank our audience. If this is your first time listening, well, thanks for coming along. You've got many other episodes to listen to. I do want to thank you. If you do want to continue our conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.